is side two of tape number 397, July 13th, 1979. Dr. Cyril Wecht is a coroner from Allegheny County in Pennsylvania. Many of you know of him. And he's a lawyer, a doctor. And when they began their open hearings on television with the House Select Committee going into the assassination of John Kennedy, Cyril Wecht gave a beautiful speech. He should get the Nobel Peace Prize for what he said, his honesty and his clarity about the direction of where the headshots came from. September the 7th, Ida Dox, the medical illustrator, was the one who spoke about the holes in John Kennedy's head. We couldn't get a view of the photographs or the x-rays. Dr. Michael Rockefeller Cremation Baden, Dr. Michael Baden from New York City, was the head of the medical team on the Kennedy assassination, the retry, the second investigation. Dr. James J. Byrne, I call him Byrne, the autopsy papers, Humes, nervously testified, and Dr. Cyril Wecht testified, and he gave the dissenting opinion that the shots did not come from the back of the head. And that evening, up to that time, the hearings were televised, public broadcasting. That evening, all hearings were no longer televised at the House Select Committee on Assassinations. What's so disturbing about this new report coming out about the forgeries is that Robert Groden testified, as I say, on September the 6th, but it seems, according to the newspaper reports, that he knew last July about these forgeries. And the newspaper doesn't always print things correctly, so we have to find out when Robert Groden realized that these were forgeries or if the newspaper report is wrong. Because as a consultant to the House Select Committee on Assassinations, he talked about photographic evidence, a man seen at the Dow Tex building, and other photographic evidence that the committee never addressed themselves to. But if he kept silent on September the 6th and talked about the list of photographic evidence and ignored the fact that these were forgeries and was quiet all that time, that is a very dangerous and terrible position to be in. He should have spoken up like Cyril Wecht and broken the story right open, right there. That's when they should have had a press conference. That's where the committee should have begun with the assassin and the fatal headshot at the fence instead of closing there. That's where they always should have begun, and the last day is where they ended. And now their report is going to talk about, I understand, about this other evidence, but if they knew it in July before they went public, this is disgraceful. And again, I say the only reason they're coming out and closing their committee with the story that there was a conspiracy is that they were blackmailed, their evidence was photographed, they didn't want to go into the evidence of the conspiracy that was given to them by many, many researchers, so they twiddled around, used up the $6 million, took up the time, ran out yelling, "It's a conspiracy, and if you have to, blame organized crime." I know it won't work, but the manipulations of the energy, the news media, the intent is so wasted and drained, and the people in charge are so corrupt that you just watch them operate, and you see how sneaky they are in dribbling out information that belongs to all of us, and it doesn't belong for them to decide what we can see. One brief word about General Alexander Haig that we talked about on the tapes launching his agent provocateur presidential campaign. You've noticed a few weeks have elapsed. They haven't even come up with a suspect unless they arrest themselves for that bang-bang, you know, of his car that was destroyed. The story's been dropped from the news. There's not a word about it. The only reference he had is his press conference. He's been saying that he wants to speak out on security for the United States. Haig says he has no political affiliation. He's available for both parties. He worked with President Nixon. He also worked with John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. And he says, "I know what my leanings are, but I refuse to say if I ever voted." Haig retired with a speech on world terrorism. He blamed global disease of terrorism on the Soviet Union. He recalled in the newspapers his recent brush with death. He blamed totalitarian regimes of the East with a large measure of responsibility for international disease of terrorism. If you read the newspapers about what's going on in Rhodesia and South Africa and Uganda, Cambodia, Vietnam, Laos, Chile, Nicaragua, Iran, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, Guyana, the Central Intelligence Agency put in these governments. They put in the Greek military junta that was torturing and had its brief existence from 1967. It lasted just a few years, and they were able to overthrow it. But it was put in by the Central Intelligence Agency and the Defense Department. We've sent instruments of torture to this country. And the United States is doing mass terrorism, starvation, and war, sending weapons, the biggest supplier of weapons and weapon machinery and counterintelligence over the entire world. And Haig wants to run for president of the United States on the basis that the Eastern Soviet regime is responsible for international disease of terrorism. The disease of terrorism reached its height under the Tsar and the Tsarists and their pogroms. And when the Tsar was kicked out, they moved to Eastern Europe and then to Germany and Austria and France and Poland and got really strong in the techniques of assassination and terrorism. Haig is nothing but a warlord who never really went to war, and his political career is launched. But I just want to call attention that the weeks have gone by, and you haven't even seen a suspect brought in. There's no member of the party he's talking about, you know, and he's made up that entire scheme to launch his campaign. Me too, they wanted me, and if they want me, I must be hard on communists. And he wants you to equate the strength he gets from knowing that if he was a possible victim in an assassination attempt, it was because he's so strong on the communists. The same psychology was used at the time of the John Kennedy assassination with the so-called assassination attempt on General Walker in April, where a bullet went through the window. And this bullet was planned at Fort Bragg, South Carolina. It was an U.S. Army strategy. Later, it was blamed on Lee Harvey Oswald. I may do another tape. I think I did a show on KLRB on that quite a few years ago, because I've been doing the radio shows for 8 years now. But I may go back into the Walker shooting sometime for you in detail. But it's that same mentality. As soon as John Kennedy was killed, General Walker was giving an interview with a magazine in Germany saying, the same person that killed John Kennedy shot at me. It was Lee Harvey Oswald. When there wasn't any ballistic evidence, witness evidence to make the connection, he was sitting in an open window April the 10th, 1963, and a bullet goes right through the window into the bookcase. But General Walker becomes the victim of the same kind of political terrorism as John Kennedy, to show you that one side of the political spectrum isn't vulnerable, that the other is too. That's what General Haig was doing. It would be interesting if they ever even bring up the case again of the car and the bomb just days before he was supposed to leave NATO. Another name is in the news. We can update a few of the tapes that we've done before. Back in January of 79, on January 19th and 26th, those are tape 372 and 373, I talked about John Paisley and the coincidence of John Paisley disappearing in September of 1978, just a week after CIA agent John Hart testified about Yuri Nosenko, the Soviet defector, the KGB defector that worked with Lee Harvey Oswald and Marina Oswald's papers in the Soviet Union. And as soon as John Hart surfaced and talked about Nosenko, John Paisley, who was an interpreter and worked closely with the KGB double agent Yuri Nosenko, who was actually working with the Galen operation and the CIA, it was that week that Paisley died. Now, there's new controversy about the autopsy of John Paisley. His wife, many of you know, hired Bernard Fensterwald from the Committee to Investigate Assassinations and a CIA attorney to represent her. And now two people have come forward to speak up about what they saw on his neck, a Dr. George Weems and another party who saw the body when it was turned over after it was brought out of the water. They claim that the neck was cut, the throat was cut or by a cord or a marking. That Harry Langley, the owner of Langley Point Marina, was the second person, along with Dr. George Williams from Calvert County, who saw the body, and they felt that the neck had the signs of strangling and that the throat had been burned or cut. Now, all of that was kept quiet until 3 weeks ago, when the insurance company refused to give Mary Ann Paisley the life insurance for her husband on the basis that they thought he was still alive. But after that came out, these men felt sorry for her, and they spoke up, and Bernard Fencerwald had a press conference in Washington, D.C. They were asked why they didn't mention the throat markings before. It was a happy year, and Dr. Weems said, well, he didn't want to speak up because he was never asked to, that he performed the preliminary examination of the body, and that his report made no mention of the neck mark in his first report. He sent the body to the state medical examiner, and he said it wasn't his job to make a thorough examination of the body. The state medical examiner does it, but he said it was foul play and murder, and he couldn't keep quiet any longer. The story at first was that John Paisley had committed suicide. That's what the CIA wanted everyone to believe. The autopsy in Maryland, the state medical examiner, Dr. Russell Fisher, didn't mention any throat markings to suggest murder on John Paisley. And Harry Langley said, I call it foul play. I knew Paisley from the marina. And he said he kept quiet because he was told to keep quiet by the officials. They said, don't keep quiet on what you've seen. They told him Paisley was in the CIA. And he thought this was all top government secret business, and he didn't want to get into it. As I say, until 3 weeks ago, Paisley was insured for several hundred thousand dollars. Now they reversed the decision and decided to give Mary Ann Paisley the insurance money based upon the fact that there were five fingerprints taken from the body that matched John Paisley's fingerprints, that the dental plates matched the plates of Paisley, and that the underwear that was too large for him was a gift, and he wore it. There's some people that say John Paisley is alive in the Soviet Union, and I may do some reports on that in the next week or two. But the important thing is that if this was foul play, it gets so flagrant. I would rather believe, even with my age of innocence gone a long time ago, that somebody gets away and isn't murdered, because I have a list of people that were working on the John Kennedy assassination and were involved and testified, that were about to testify before Senator Church's committee. Sheffield Edwards testified, and he died May 1975. He was murdered. Sam Giancana was going to testify, and he died June 20th, 1975. John Roselli testified before the Senator Church Committee on the Assassinations, and he died in August of 76. Donald Donaldson never got to testify for the House Select Committee. He died in December of 77, when there was reason to believe that he had given President Carter and the House Select Committee on Assassinations information on the murder of John Kennedy. George de Morenschelt died March 1977, the day he was to be interviewed by the House Select Committee. Gary Powers died August the 1st, 1977. He was involved with Mr. Thomas Karamessine and Lee Harvey Oswald. The U-2 flight over the Soviet Union that broke up the meeting with Khrushchev and Eisenhower, and also John Paisley would have been very much part of this, with John Hart and Yuri Nosenko. William Sullivan died in May 1977. William Harvey, after going to the Church Committee in June of 76, Vice Admiral Rufus Taylor died September 14th, 1978, two weeks before John Hart testified. He was dead. And Nelson Rockefeller, who was named by Donald Donaldson, died in February 1979. Thomas Karamessine died in September 1978, September 14th, just the time that John Paisley was to disappear on the 23rd of September and be dead. And Paul Rygotarotsky, an agent, an elderly man who worked with these people, who lived in the Houston, Fort Worth, Dallas area, also died in 1977, weeks before George de Morenschelt was found dead. De Morenschelt died in April of 77, not March. So John Paisley another link to all of these people. Whether the rope around his neck was around another man disguised as John Paisley, or whether it was John Paisley, I suppose now we will never know. The newspapers covering this new Paisley story about the burns on the neck and the rope and the threats to keep quiet were covered. The articles were covered in various newspapers, but the only newspaper that mentioned Yuri Nosenko that I have, and maybe other papers will be coming in the next few weeks, was from the Houston Post. It was sent to me from a friend and listener in Houston, Texas, June 11, 1979. That's the only paper I have that mentioned Yuri Nosenko as being his name mentioned in a book that Marianne Paisley turned over to the authorities. Now, there's a Mr. Maloof, Calvert County State Attorney, who has said some people don't want the truth out in this case. There are key areas that we were looking at in the case. We could have cracked it, but they gave us so much flack. A Lawrence Lamson, who's now the district court judge in the area, said the state police in Maryland are unwilling to go to the wall and force the CIA to give them information. It's time we do this thing and do it right. The state police refuse to bring files here, and they have 500 pages of transcripts and a lot of leads, and nobody will follow them. I take that back. They said they have 5,000 pages of transcripts with a lot of leads, and no one followed it. I can see if you were investigating something how you could get that. I could produce 5,000 pages of leads on the SLA story, on the Jonestown family story, the Guyana massacres, on the Rockefeller murder, on the Paisley affair. These things are so grossly handled and controlled that I'm wondering when the people of this country are going to realize just how much the intelligence community controls the justice, the police, the district attorneys, the Supreme Court, the prosecutors, the defense. It just seems impossible to get at the heart of all of these scandals because of the control there is over the judicial system. Marianne Paisley has turned over the names that were in a book that belonged to her husband. I guess that was finally her barter. Again, blackmail and bullets. They weren't going to give her insurance. They said he was still alive, but now she's going to collect all the insurance. And I'm sure that when she turned over this book, it contained what you call red names, which is a list of secret names. The CIA puts a strip of red tape down the left edge, which is to tell you that these papers are not to be removed from the CIA. And John Paisley had with him, this is in September, a week after the testimony about Yuri Nosenko and the House Select Committee on Assassinations trying to find out who killed John Kennedy, he had with him from the CIA headquarters a book that mentioned the name of Yuri Nosenko and Captain Nicholas Shadrin, another spy. A paper from Wilmington, Delaware, talked about another agent, Arkady Shevchenko, who was a UN delegate. Each newspaper, and I have clippings from eight newspapers, has its own little piece of information, and you have to take the sum total and put it together. But it seems that a major witness to this assassination was murdered, or as I say, if he defected, he's as good as gone. I doubt if he defected because of the importance of this story of Yuri Nosenko. But if Paisley was murdered cold-bloodedly and Mr. Karamazin died just at the same time, George de Moranchil, Carlos Prio Siqueiros, all of these people, Gary Powers, all of them, one after the other, dying at a time when the Congress has been given $6 million to investigate political assassinations. One of the parts of the book that I'm doing on the doubles of Lee Harvey Oswald is the death of the major witnesses that would prove or substantiate the allegations of the various doubles. Many of them died these untimely deaths, such as Sheriff Craig, who saw Lee Harvey Oswald go out the front of the building, or Mr. Worrell, who saw him leave the back of the building, or a man who saw him get into a bus, Mr. McWaters, or Mary Bledsoe, who said he was on the bus. He couldn't have been on the bus if he was in the car that Sheriff Craig talked about. or the cab driver, William Whaley, or the rooming house lady, Earlene Roberts. You go down and down the list, and the witnesses, to verify the story or to substantiate it, to clarify it, died right after the assassination, and they kept being killed afterwards. So all you can do is write the story and include in it what the witnesses saw, what they said, and how they died, and let the reader come to their own conclusion and then maybe add it up themselves. And I think that's an important part of these hearings and books that isn't done as the story is written. How the person died, they say this person's deceased, and they refer to them as deceased, but they died just at the peak of the inquiry. They die sudden deaths, untimely deaths. It happened with the Kennedy assassination, and of course anything that touches the investigation, the deaths just keep rolling along. And it looks like the John Paisley story is one more piece of evidence of his, at that time, having information about Yuri Nosenko. I wrote about that in Penn Jones' continuing inquiry. Some of you have that, and I think on another sheet I gave you the address to order it. It's a good article about, I think it's a good article, about John Paisley, Yuri Nosenko, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and I bring it up again because it's in the news again, and I just want to update and remind you how these sores just keep coming on and won't resolve themselves until somebody decides to tell the truth. There's another sad story in the news, which I should update, and that's about David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, a young, idealistic boy, Jewish boy, who went to South Korea in the war, wrote home about his disillusionment of war, wanted to have peace, corresponding with his girlfriend, put in an army hospital, comes home a real weirdo, works for the federal government in the post office, but then is accused of being the person that did all those murders, the son of Sam. He said he was influenced by Sam Carr and the dog that was talking to him. The Sam Carr connections were never opened up. Sam's son was murdered on a military base. Remember way back we did a tape on that? And I did several tapes back in August of 1978 on David Berkowitz. I'll try to update the story. It's a shame that he was cut up. The New York Times just came out with a big article before the attempted killing of David Berkowitz called The Unmasking Son of Sam's Demons. They want to take away the idea that the dog or Sam Carr had anything to do with the influencing of David Berkowitz in doing the murders. But that's just a whitewash, and I don't believe that they're honest. The psychiatrists are not honest about when he started to be influenced by voices and influenced by the people around him and could be manipulated to become the murderer he was. And there were many people that could have stopped him along the way and didn't, and let it run its full course with terror in New York. And the police department gains, the media gains. It's a shame that he was attacked. I think they would like to kill him. The prison systems like to get rid of their patsies, because if he could ever be deprogrammed, another story might come out. And I think that's very important, that those people be kept alive and get the opportunity once in their lifetime to meet an honest psychiatrist and let the psychiatrist stay with them and unlock the secret of what goes on in their minds. They rebroadcast this week the Operation Mind Control on television, that investigative story of mind control. And if you saw it once or saw it twice, it is a national, international disgrace what the United States intelligence system has done to these human beings. There was a murder in San Francisco this week. The headline, of course, saying Academy Awards streaker killed in holdup. San Jose Mercury called it a holdup. They already, in 1 hour after the man is killed, had solved the crime. The murderers wanted $5. The man had his head blown off, and problem was solved. The San Francisco Examiner the same day had a different story, but the headline was the same. San Francisco gallery owner is slain for $5. Now, what they're doing is solving the motive. There's no investigation. One says it was a holdup. The other says it was for $5. One version says that somebody came in, two men came into the apartment where Robert Opel, 39 years of age, lived. He was with two friends, a man and a woman. They were taken in another room. The bandit took their $5. They pulled out a shotgun and said, "We're going to blow off your head." And they did, and they left. Opel died, and they left. That's the San Jose Mercury. The San Francisco Chronicle says that Robert Opel was the man who staged a mock execution of Dan White in San Francisco. There was a gay freedom parade. He was also the man who streaked before the Academy Award presentations in 1974, but that isn't why he was killed. He held a mock execution of Dan White, the slayer of George Marconi and Supervisor Milk at the United Nations Plaza in San Francisco. He pretended that he was shooting a friend who was dressed up all in white. Now, two men entered the apartment. One, who was believed to be the killer, was wearing a brown leather jacket with a large diamond stick pin. After taking the $5, they told the witnesses, in quotes, "You haven't seen us before, but if you see us again, you're dead." And they left the building. Now, this blowing off the head, just blowing the head off of the man who had the mock execution of Dan White, makes me believe that these were off-duty cops, that they'll be seen again, or they're hired gunmen. There's a death squad in San Francisco, and it's similar to in Brazil or Argentina, and it goes also in New York, to kill the gay people. There was a whole series of burnings of bathhouses and institutions where the gay people belong. The reason they said, "If you see us again, you will be dead," is that they know they'll be seen again, and you better not speak up. They didn't intend to kill three people. They came in for one man, the man who had the mock execution of Dan White. They wanted him. They took the other two people out of the room. They blew his head off. They said to the others, "Just be quiet." And what it reminded me of was the era of the rock musicians that began to be killed one by one. I worked with the gay community during the COINTELPRO program through the Watergate periods in terms of speaking to various editors of gay magazines, trying to get them interested into the assassination teams and the blight on our country. Incidentally, Meet the Press this last Sunday, July the 7th, had the ambassador Argentine talking, and you can order that program of Meet the Press. Maybe save me time of writing in and you order one for me. Get an extra copy. They were talking about missing people and death squads in Argentine, and what this person said, representing the Argentine government, was, "All of our murders come bunched together at one time, and it seems pretty bad. But you have John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King," and he's saying the same thing that Idi Amin said to us: "How can you tell me to run my country when you're killing your own leaders?" And on Meet the Press, he was throwing it back to us. How do you criticize Argentine with your own death squads that work similar to Brazil or Chile or Argentine? Now, just 10 years ago, in 1969, was the height of the hippie movement. It culminated with Woodstock. This summer is the 10th anniversary of Woodstock, the so-called Age of Aquarius, and the anti-war movement, the young people getting it together, followed out in California by Altamont, in which the CIA and the intelligence community used the Hell's Angels for a ritualistic murder filmed in the movie Gimme Shelter, just at the time that they're singing a song about John Kennedy. That was the summer of Chappaquiddick. Chappaquiddick was the same night as the landing on the moon. It was the height of the FBI COINTELPRO program. Maybe very soon I'll do, on the anniversary of that, give you a rundown of the killing of the rock musicians, of turning the music into what we call the Bass Outlet, Organized Crime, Music Corporation of America, Warner Brothers. The music scene has become the commercial, now the hard rock and the disco. The whole folk scene was taken over, and it took about the murder of about 48 to 50 musicians to own it and control it and keep it where they wanted it to be. And the same way with the gay community, they can't see that the gay leaders or the people that speak up will be killed, just as the early rock musicians were killed. And I just believe that this, what they called the $5 burglary, and the skill with which they isolated the people they didn't want to kill, and the message they left, "If you see us again, shut up," what they were saying to Robert Opel was, "Don't carry any mock execution for Dan White. We represent White Knight, the white killer, we'll blow your heads off. And any of you that pull that stunt again, we'll blow your heads off. This was the murder of a particular person. $5 didn't mean anything to them. And the point will go across to the gay community. And until they understand the whole era of assassination of presidents, civil rights leaders, rock musicians, scientists, judges, they can't defend themselves. You have to understand the whole blanket, the assassination syndrome, to understand how to survive. And it's when you put this history together of the agencies and the people and the way they operate, then you'll be able to stop these street murders. Our time is up. Maybe next week I'll do an anniversary of Aldemont and Woodstock. It's appropriate for the summer season. Take care of yourself. This is Mae Russell in Carmel, and I'll be with you next week.